It's Wednesday, October 19th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, the push is on against Islamic State in Mosul.
So that women in politics have to prove both that they hold masculine qualities of leadership, but still also hold feminine personality traits.
We look at the dynamics of women running for public office. Also ahead, China has a new charity law and a new direction for one member of One Direction. It's all on today's International Edition. Iraq's long-anticipated assault on the Islamic State-held city of Mosul is underway, with Iraqi Kurdish Regional President Masoud Barzani saying 200 square kilometers have already been liberated. The bulk of some 30,000 fighters involve Iraqi security force members, Kurdish Peshmerga, and Sunni tribal fighters confronting an estimated 4,000 to 8,000 Islamic State militants to end more than 2 years of IS occupation of Iraq's second-largest city. Peter Cook is a U.S. defense spokesman.
This fight is taking place with Iraqis firmly in the lead, including thousands of Iraqi army personnel, counterterrorism forces, and federal police. Kurdish Peshmerga and Sunni tribal forces are also playing a critical role in this fight. Early indications are that Iraqi forces have met their objectives so far. This is going according to the Iraqi plan, but again, it's early, and the enemy gets a vote here. We will see whether ISIL stands and fights. We are confident, no matter what, however, that the Iraqis have the capabilities to get this job done, and we stand ready to support them along with the rest of the coalition. It is in our interest that they succeed, and we will do what we can to help them.
Coalition Commander Lieutenant General Stephen Townsend said the operation would likely continue for weeks, possibly longer. U.S. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter has called the offensive a decisive moment in the campaign to deliver the Islamic State group a lasting defeat. U.S. Ambassador James Jeffrey, now a distinguished fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, tells VOA's Victor Beatty cooperation between Iraqi forces and the Kurdish Peshmerga is nothing new. He said they fought together many times during the U.S. presence in Iraq in the last decade, and the Peshmerga comprise several brigades of the Iraqi army.
This is a very good development because the two sides have coordinated closely, and these are the two major forces that are going in. The rest are problematic because basically some of the Sunni militias and police, because they've been trained by the Turks and the popular mobilization units, because some of them are beholden to Iran. But those aren't the primary actors in this fight.
Is there a concern that some Shia militia being used could pose a problem for the mostly Sunni population inside Mosul?
Everybody's concerned with that. We were concerned about that in the earlier battles, Tikrit, Fallujah, and Ramadi. The only time they really ran amok was in around Fallujah, basically before the sea was liberated in some of the outlying towns. But that really did happen, and that has everybody worried it could happen again. But there seems to be a major effort to try to keep them away from the front. Unless the circumstances are special, they won't get U.S. air support or artillery support, and that's an important factor as well.
Americans, we're told, are playing an advisory or enabling role for the Iraqi forces.
That's true, but it's a massive role compared to what Obama was doing before, with a lot of American advisory teams on the front lines, these JTACs, Joint Terminal Attack Coordinators, basically forward observers. And then, of course, all of these people have escort detachments that basically get, you know, platoon-sized American forces with a lot of forward battalions up close to the fighting. And these guys will get involved. They'll certainly be shot at, and they'll probably return fire, call in airstrikes, call in artillery. That's their job.
The strategy, I understand, is to move in from the east. Well, how do you see the strategy unfolding for final victory?
It's from the east with the Peshmerga and a little bit from the north, and from the south from this place called Kayada, which is a air base that you have most of the American forces based out of now. That's about 40 miles south of Mosul, and that's why much of the fighting now is taking place in the Nineveh Plain around Mosul. But they'll eventually fight their way through this band and get to the city. That's when the real fighting will begin.
Well, the commander of the coalition, U.S. Lieutenant General Stephen Townsend, said the operation to take the second largest city in Iraq could likely last weeks, possibly longer.
The Fallujah battle in a much smaller city with the U.S. in the lead in 2004 lasted with the cleanup about 3 weeks. and things were dicey for a good long time after then. And Mosul will take longer, I'm pretty sure.
As for the possibility that as many as 1 million civilians may be caught in the crossfire, James Jeffries said it's possible a surge of new refugees will add to the 8 million displaced by the Syrian civil war and the Islamic State. Time for us now to check out what's buzzing online. International Edition's social media reporter G. Abby Lee is here to do just that. Hi, G.
Hi, Jim.
So, Netflix, no longer in China, correct?
That's right. The streaming video service issued an earnings report Monday, and in the report, Netflix acknowledged its expansion plans in China were not successful. The reason being, in its own words, the regulatory environment for foreign digital content services in China has become challenging.
Probably not a huge surprise to many China watchers. Mm-hmm. So what's the online buzz about that?
So people are joking Netflix's new brilliant strategy for China is to stay the hell out of there. Another person tweeted, quite accurately, that no homosexuality, no witchcraft, no Netflix in China. That means you can't show these things in public media, or rather just media, popular media in China. Instead, the company will spend $6 billion on content production.
Okay. What else happens to be trending?
The next story is also from an American company. Delta Airlines is trending on social media with people sharing photos of its new uniforms. Delta collaborated with New York fashion designer Zac Posen to create new uniforms for more than 60,000 employees. It's mostly in gray, purple, and red. Online users are saying they like the throwback to the 60s and 70s, and definitely the female flight attendants' uniforms look like they were inspired by former First Lady Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis. Another thing I found quite interesting is that some of the new Delta travel bags are now on eBay for around $150 each.
Wow.
They're very pretty.
Well, I wonder if some of the employees were allowed to sell those.
Probably not.
Well, we have a few seconds remaining for one final story. What else do you have?
Well, we have words of encouragement from north of the border. Canadians took to YouTube to tell us what they admire and like about America using hashtag Tell America It's Great. In the video, they mentioned the U.S. government created the internet, and they like a lot of things, including our expansive national parks and American music. Back to you, Jim.
All right, we'll use the hashtag GAbbyLeeIsGreat. What a great wrap-up. Thank you so much, G. You can follow us on our Twitter feed at @VOA_IE and on our individual accounts at @VOAStevenson and at @GAbbyLee. Among the top stories that are trending in Asia, Australia denies allegations of torture at migrant camp. Afghan government in secret talks with Taliban. Local communities weigh cost of Vietnam's economic growth. Myanmar fires border police chief over deadly insurgent attacks. U.S. election rhetoric alarms Asia-Pacific partners. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories, a whole lot more as well, at our voanews.com website and also via our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. Increasingly confident of winning the U.S. presidency in the November election, Democrat Hillary Clinton is expanding her campaign into traditionally Republican states in hopes of closing off a path to victory for Republican Donald Trump and to support the election of more Democratic lawmakers in Congress. With 3 weeks until Election Day, the Clinton campaign says it will spend $2 million more in advertising in the western state of Arizona, which has voted for a Democratic presidential contender just once in the last 16 elections. In addition, the Clinton campaign is also ramping up its efforts in two Midwestern states where Donald Trump leads. Those are Missouri and Indiana. Both states have closely contested Senate races that Democrats and Republicans view as important in their efforts to win political control next year in the Senate, where Republicans now have a majority. Recent polls show Clinton, a former U.S. Secretary of State, seeking to become the country's first female president, surging to a bigger lead over Trump, a brash real estate mogul making his first run for elected office. The political website Real Clear Politics says its average of national surveys shows Clinton with a 7 percentage point advantage, while several political analysts say that she has about a 9 in 10 chance of becoming the country's 45th president. The 2016 U.S. election campaign is unusual on many fronts, but one aspect of it is, of course, truly historic. For the first time, a major party has nominated a woman as its presidential candidate. But what took so long to reach this milestone in a country at the forefront of efforts to promote women's empowerment and advancement around the world? And how do assumptions about a women's role affect the public's response to a female candidate? Kata Kostrecki has more.
Clinton's camp has often maintained that gender bias is at play in the criticism towards her. Michelle Swartz, a professor of American government at Georgetown University, says people still associate toughness and leadership qualities with men.
And a woman travels in a narrower lane, so that women in politics have to prove both that they hold masculine qualities of leadership, but still also hold feminine personality traits that people assume women have.
Swartz says that Clinton is often criticized as being too cold and calculating. But on the other hand, when she shows her softer side, she elicits the opposite reaction, says Sonia Michel, a University of Maryland professor emerita who focuses on the history of women and gender.
And the more she tries to avoid those kinds of criticisms, people say, well, is she strong enough? Is she firm enough? Is, you know, how can she operate on a world stage?
But Professor Swartz says criticism Clinton receives is not only due to gender bias.
I think the criticisms related to the email servers and the campaign donations to the Clinton Foundation are legitimate in that they question values that we hold about transparency, about honesty, about character in our leadership.
But she says it's easy for those questions to overlap into the area of gender bias because women candidates are supposed to be more honest, more trustworthy, more likable, and more prepared, says Spanish broadcast journalist Dori Toribio.
That's the thing with women in politics. You have to be older, you have to be tougher, and in my point of view, you have to be 10 times better than a man so that you can get to that point. You have to prove yourself all the time.
On November 9, the world will know whether U.S. voters choose a woman as president, shattering the highest of glass ceilings. Kata Kostrecki, VOA News, Washington.
And you can check out video to that story on our website at voanews.com. China has a new charity law. It went into force last month, regulating Chinese charities on a national scale for the very first time. Beijing is hoping the law will boost charitable giving by reducing restrictions on domestic charities and making them more transparent. My colleague Michael Lippin has been taking a look at the new law for his VOA China 360 podcast. He joins me now in the studio. Michael, how does this law make life easier for the Chinese charities?
Hi, Jim. It's good to be here. Well, you know, previously, domestic Chinese charitable organizations had to register both with the Chinese Ministry of Civil Affairs and with a sponsoring government agency. Under the new law, though, domestic charities or nonprofit groups will merely need to register with the local branch of the Civil Affairs Department, so a little less red tape. They also must report all of their public fundraising activities to Chinese civil affairs authorities. Now, one American social entrepreneur who has worked with hundreds of Chinese charities in the past decade is Holly Chang. She's a New York-based executive director of the Chinese American advocacy group, the Committee of 100. I spoke to Holly Chang on the phone, and I asked her what she thinks about how China will handle the implementation of this new charity law.
You know, if the government passed this law, then they would likely invest in infrastructure to implement the law. And there's going to be training and I think anytime something changes, there's going to be adjustment. I wouldn't know specifics at this time because it was just September 1st that the new law was put into place. And surprisingly or not surprisingly, there were all these huge celebrations locally to celebrate this new charity law and the new found influence that they could have. Because I think that the Ministry of Civil Affairs that oversees this law has traditionally been a somewhat marginalized ministry. And now that there's this new law that's becoming standardized and national, they are now becoming a mainstream actor in social services, which I think, again, I generally see this as a positive thing. But implementation is always going to be difficult, especially when there's a gap in understanding and resources, and also potentially differences between local agendas and national agendas.
Well, another observer of China's new charity law is Reza Hazmath. He's a political science professor at the University of Alberta in Edmonton, Canada. When I spoke to him by phone, he said there are likely to be differences in the way the new charity law is implemented in China.
One of the issues at hand is we tend to view China as one monolithic state. I think a better way to look at China is many different states within this large entity. So in other words, there's multiple Chinas. And so the way it's going to get implemented is going to be very different in, say, Beijing than it is in a Tier 3 or Tier 4 city in the western sort of regions of China. And ultimately, although they are going to pay homage to the idea that you need to be registered as such, if you're a domestic NGO, that you need to scale and so forth, and there's funding sort of requirements, ultimately the way it gets interpreted is going to be very different depending on what local area you are in China. And that's, you know, put that into context, generally speaking, when we look at many laws out of China, particularly if they're nationally led, that's the reality that we see. We see that, you know, the implementation is always varying depending on the local sort of preferences.
Now, as you mentioned, Jim, my latest VOA China 360 podcast is about China's new charity law. In the podcast, our listeners can hear what Reza Hazmath and Holly Chang think about why China decided to make this major change to the way charities operate in the country and how it will affect both domestic charities and foreign ones. You can find the podcast on Twitter at VOA China 360, as well as on my new Facebook page, which is under my name, Michael Lippin. Jim?
Great. Thank you so much, Michael. One of the cutting-edge new topics coming out of China. You'll find them each and every week on VOA China 360, a great podcast. I urge you to subscribe.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome, Michael. You can visit voanews.com for much more on these and many other stories. Follow our Twitter stream at voa_ie and check out our Facebook page. It's VOA Now. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
The U.S. presidential election takes place on November 8, 2016. VOA provides extensive coverage of this important political event. Who are the candidates, and what are the issues that will determine who the next president will be? Tune in around the clock for coverage of the U.S. presidential election, right here on VOA.
Jazz America!
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. A member of the popular British-Irish boy band One Direction has just released a solo single. International Edition's Sarah Williams speaks with Border Crossing's host Larry London.
Well, Sarah, thanks for having me on the show. And today we're looking at one member of One Direction, a band that's been around since 2012 and formed on the very popular show X Factor on TV in the UK. And they are now on hiatus, at least that's what they're calling it, although all the members of the band are off doing solo things. Zayn Malik, who just goes by Zayn now, about 6-8 months ago, released a solo album. He was the first member of the band to go solo and release a solo album, which has done very well. Now, the second member of One Direction has actually released material. His name is Niall Horan, and he's just put out a song that he wrote and recorded called This Town. And I really like the song. I really like the sound. Niall is from Ireland. He's a very popular member of the band, well-liked by all of their fans, which are called One Directioners all around the world. So I think we should check out the new Niall Horan song.
Waking up to kiss you and nobody's there. The smell of your perfume still stuck in the air. It's hard.
Okay, well, if members of One Direction are now doing solo albums, does this mean the group might break up?
Sarah, you've asked the question of the hour. That's what all the fans want to know. Although, this past week, one of the guys in the band posted that a reunion is absolutely a possibility. Although when they first separated back in March, they said, this is only going to be a short-term thing. This is only going to be about a year. We need a breather. They just came off the road, just finished promoting their fifth album. And so we all believed and bought into that story. But then Harry Styles went off and filmed Dunkirk, signed a solo contract with Columbia Records, recorded three solo songs which have yet to be released, and the other guys in the band also working on solo material. Liam is at home taking care of his newborn son, Freddie, and Louis is working on solo material. So all the guys are doing stuff. They're involved in other things, and it's looking less and less likely that they will reunite, at least anytime soon. And this often happens, like NSYNC and all those bands that kind of go in different directions. They tend not to get back together when they've achieved success as solo artists. And Niall is on his way with his very first song now.
Okay, well, best of luck to him and to the other members of One Direction. Thanks very much, Larry. That is Larry London. He is the host of VOA's Border Crossings.
As if the whole world was watching, I'd still dance with you. Drive highways and byways, be there with you. Over and over, the only truth. Everything comes back to you.
Member of One Direction going a different direction. We're glad you came in our direction to listen to International Edition. You can always find us at voanews.com. Be sure to like us on Facebook at VOA Now. And you know what? We got a Twitter stream as well. It's at @VOA_IE. If you're not following, why don't you try it? Thanks for joining us. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Carl Starling. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We hope you have a great day ahead.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The rebalance to the Asia-Pacific region is a critical national commitment that focuses on regional prosperity and sharpening the U.S. military edge, Defense Secretary Ash Carter said on September 29th in San Diego, California. Asia-Pacific remains the single most consequential region for America's future, he said. The rebalance to the Asia-Pacific region, which President Barack Obama announced 5 years ago, includes diplomatic, economic, and military components, he explained. All of the components, Secretary Carter said, are to ensure the Asia-Pacific region remains a place where every nation can rise and prosper, even at a time of dramatic political, economic, and security change in the region. Secretary Carter highlighted security challenges in the region, including North Korea's nuclear saber-rattling that threatens allies and heightens tensions. Other challenges, he said, include maritime concerns that could hurt the region's prosperous future, as well as terrorism and transnational threats. The U.S. military, he noted, faced 5 major challenges: Russian aggression and coercion, China behaving aggressively, North Korean missile and nuclear provocations, Iranian aggression and malign influence in the Gulf, and defeating the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. The rebalance to the Asia-Pacific region has 3 parts, Secretary Carter explained. The first phase began 5 years ago, when the U.S. Department of Defense enhanced its military force posture in the region. The second phase launched last year, when the U.S. made qualitative improvements to its force posture. And the third phase will cement the progress made in the first and second phases, the secretary said. The United States will continue to invest and make high-tech improvements in its military assets to sharpen our military edge so we remain the most powerful military in the region and the security partner of choice, he added. Secretary Carter highlighted the strong ties the U.S. military has with its many allies in the region. America's regional partnerships are growing in number and strength, he said, noting that the effort entails helping to unlock the tremendous potential in the region. Secretary Carter concluded, The rebalance is about the future.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.